Ever feel like the internet is watching your every move? You Google how to fix my Wi-Fi and suddenly your feed is filled with routers. There's a reason for this. Your browser is able to watch and store your digital activity, and that's why it thinks you're fascinated by Wi-Fi or whatever else you've been searching for of late. But you can put an end to this using today's sponsor, Surfshark VPN. I've just started using Surfshark VPN and it works a treat. It encrypts everything I do online so that snoopers, trackers, or even sketchy coffee shop Wi-Fi hackers can't see what I'm up to. It also bursts through censorship and geo restrictions. So if you want to access local reporting, overseas, or foreign analysis or content that you can't get in your region, Surfshark opens that door for you. All you need is one account to secure all of your devices. Laptop, phone, tablet, even your smart TV. There's no juggling of subscriptions. It's just one click and you're done. They also have a product called Surfshark Search, which is incredible. It lets you search the web without all the ads and targeted nonsense cluttering up your search results. It really is a breath of digital fresh air. So free yourself from the tyranny of big tech today with Surfshark. Go to surfshark.com/last orders or use the promo code last orders, all one word, at the checkout for 4 extra months. That's surfshark.com/last orders or last orders promo code at checkout. You'll find all of this information in the show notes. There's also a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk, just secure browsing. Do check it out.
It is a colossal, in terms of tobacco, unprecedented criminal disaster. And yet, as far as I can tell, no one in Australia, apart from a few libertarians, are saying, you know what, maybe it would be better if we just let people smoke.
There's this really, I think, kind of troubling phenomena of a country which is suffering from a bit of an, I guess, an identity crisis.
Everyone now is useless. If you ask anyone to do anything in any kind of commercial environment, customer service, something like that, it's always, it's at best 50-50 that it's going to happen.
Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the IA. How are you doing, Chris?
Fine, absolutely fantastic. Tom, how are you?
I'm very well. You've got no kind of travel-related grievances to relitigate?
No. I've had a very easy journey here. No dogs in my way. Very few. Well, actually, there were a bunch of wheelie suitcases. I took a photo at Gatwick. I'll show you later. But that didn't actually get my way. It was just people getting off the train.
Thank God, because we really tested people's patience, I think, with the what felt like 20 minutes at the beginning of the last episode.
I think that's why people tune in. Could be wrong.
We shall find out. We're also delighted to be joined by Will Kingston, 1/5 of the Saturday Five on GB News, as well as the host of the Fire at Will podcast over at The Spectator. How are you doing, Will?
G'day, lads. I'm good. Long-time listener, so a privilege to be on.
It's brilliant to have you, and it's also particularly good to have you because we want to talk about a lot of Australian stories today. Chris, shall we kick off with something that we've touched on the show before, which is this long-running kind of gang warfare spate of firebombings that have been going on in Australia around tobacconists, around vape shops, seemingly kind of various different gangs and motorcycle clubs and so on, trying to kind of muscle their way in to this racket which has been created by the ban on disposable vapes and by pretty
vapes
exorbitant
in general.
Vapes in general, yeah. Of course, they've all sort of gone. This is potentially a kind of taste of things to come as we ban our own disposable vapes. So do you want to tell us a little bit about what's been going on there? Because I know you've been looking into this quite a lot recently.
They've had well over 200 firebombings now. The firebombings are of vape shops and tobacconists. The vape shops are basically illegal. You can only get a vape from a pharmacist these days, and very few people do because there's a massive moral panic about vapes in Australia. Like a lot of people in Australia, including a lot of doctors, think they're actually worse for you than cigarettes.
Well, there's a moral panic about pretty much everything.
Yes, indeed there is. Okay, we'll get you to say more about that in a minute. But yeah, the basic fact is, for about the last 18 months, there have just been like full-on prohibition-style gangland shootings and arson attacks on the earn or burn principle. This is what it's known as. So you get these gangsters going to legitimate shops saying, you're not selling, you know, government-approved cigarettes anymore. You're selling our cigarettes and you're selling our vapes. And if you don't, we'll burn your shop down. And this has been going on for a long time. There's no end in sight. There have been several people murdered, including, quote, innocent people. There's been some gangland people die, but also some poor woman had a house burnt down because these idiots got the wrong address. It is a colossal... in terms of tobacco, unprecedented criminal disaster. And yet, as far as I can tell, no one in Australia, apart from a few libertarians, are saying, you know what, maybe it would be better if we just let people smoke and let people vape. Would that actually be worse than living in a country where you just don't know if some building's going to go up in flames at 3 a.m?
I mean, are they even admitting to the fact that that's what's sparked this?
Because often there's been an acknowledgement of it. Well, ask Will. He's the Australian.
Yeah, there is. Like, it's pretty obvious that, you know, you have these kind of gangs that are targeting vape shops. And look, the problem is, A, similar to the Conservatives in the UK, the Liberal Party in Australia has completely given up on civil liberties and individual freedoms and all of those good things that centre-right political parties used to care about but seemingly no longer do. We all know that the left in Australia, just like the UK, are now very comfortable being authoritarian. So there's no one really having a voice to start to stand up for these sorts of civil liberty issues. But the other thing which, you know, crosses my mind here, and we were talking about this on my podcast the other day, Chris, is no one ever thinks about the second order consequences of these sorts of nanny state policies. Like, you know, that sort of the, you know, the problem of having shops being blown to smithereens never entered the conversation. You know, this it was just, well, you know, these vapes are obviously harmful to kitties, so let's get rid of them. We never actually take that next step to say, what are the more holistic implications of this?
And tell us a bit more, Will, about this moral panic about vapes, because it does seem like Australia's become certainly one of the world leaders in cracking down on this, you know, life-saving device very zealously.
Yeah, can I even take a step back to, I guess, the mood in Australia more generally? And, you know, a lot of people listening would think of Australia as that country of rugged individualists and irreverence and anti-authoritarianism and being laid back and all those sorts of Crocodile Dundee stereotypes.
I'm glad you brought up the cliche so I don't have to. That's very useful. But no.
And the problem is, I think the Australia that you see today, there is this massive cognitive dissonance going on because so many people still like to think of themselves in that way. But if you look at the policies in Australia today, they are now wholly authoritarian. The public are not irreverent. The public are not laid back. And you saw that in COVID. You see that with policies like vaping. And so there's this really, I think, kind of troubling phenomena of a country which is suffering from a bit of an identity crisis. You can maybe make the argument the UK is going through something similar. But
yeah, you could. And the Irish and the New Yorkers and the Californians, you know, all the people who have this reputation for being anti-authoritarian, we do what we like, they were the first ones to capitulate to this stuff. It's a great paradox. I don't fully understand that people say this about English people, or British people all the time. I thought you guys believed in liberty. You know, I released a nanny state index a few weeks ago, and I did an interview with someone in France going like, well, in France, we're kind of used to the government bossing us around, but we thought you guys were the individualists. I said, nah, that's not for a long time.
There is a Libertarian Party in Australia. I think you've got about 1% of the vote.
Not bad.
Yeah,
not
very good Libertarian Party. For Libertarians.
Yeah, that's right. But the sad reality is, again, similar to a lot of Western countries, free speech and civil liberties are a pretty tough political sell in Australia. And the best example of that was in COVID, where you saw so many people who were very happy to have their civil liberties restricted by authoritarian state governments.
So why is this? This is a question I want to ask. So we're not just talking about Australia. Like I say, we're talking about Britain as well. Why have these countries that seem to be so freedom-loving been the first to bend over for these people? I don't get it.
There's the Constantin Kissin argument that because you've never seen firsthand the consequences of full-blown, say, communism or full-blown dictatorial regimes, that you become complacent. And I think there is certainly an air of complacency in the West today. I think that plays a part in it.
And is there also the sort of the extent to which there's obviously a liberal streak, but there's also a kind of puritanical streak which exists in a lot of the societies that we're talking about? And those are always going to be vying for some level of, you know, one up over the other. I mean, you know, America is the land of the free. It's also the land that gave us prohibition and the most disastrous experiment that we've seen.
Interesting you mentioned prohibition, because there is a theory I've read, you know, in an academic study, looking at why some countries 100 years ago went for prohibition and other countries just weren't interested at all. And we're talking virtually neighbouring states. And the theory I saw, which has some legs, I think, is that the countries that went for prohibition or nearly went for prohibition, Australia, very close referendum prohibition. New Zealand had five referendums, which was like 51-49.
They're just trying to get the right answer.
And Australia had the 6 o'clock swill, right? Until the 60s, where the pubs were closed at 6 p.m.
Yeah.
So you finish work at five, drink as much as you can. And that was a compromise because they hadn't quite got prohibition, but Iceland had prohibition, Finland had prohibition, Russia had prohibition. There was a strong temperance movement in Ireland, certainly in Scotland, to some extent in England, and obviously had prohibition in America and Canada. What unites these countries? Well, most of them are English-speaking. Nearly all of them, apart from Ireland, are Protestant. Okay, not Russia, I guess, but Russia was kind of weird, the reasons they had prohibition. The things that seem to unite these the temperance countries of 100 or so years ago were North European or Anglophone, in terms of like the colonies or whatever, the previous colonies. Spirits drinking as opposed to wine drinking. Protestant. The Protestant Catholic thing seems quite clear, and the spirits versus wine thing seems quite clear. So even in France, there was no interest at all in the temperance movement. Sweden, Norway, Finland, all these countries that were very Protestant and very heavy on the spirits drinking, they went for it. In America, there was a big split between the Catholics and the Protestants. In some ways, the prohibition was the victory that the Protestants had over the Catholics, that the countryside had over the cities as well. And it seems to me that those countries that either had prohibition or very nearly had prohibition are all the countries that have now gone headlong in to the nanny state. I haven't thought about how much it correlates with COVID lockdowns, but probably pretty closely. And certainly correlates very closely with like anti-smoking regulations. So
you mentioned the Protestant Catholic thing. All of those countries have seen a decline in religiosity over the last 50 to 70 years. And I'm just thinking out loud, but I do wonder if that plays into this story as well. I definitely think in terms of the broader identity politics movement, the decline in religion has created a vacuum, which identity politics, among other troubling ideologies, has certainly filled. I think that is a part of this story in some way.
And also just politicians who don't really know what they're for anymore. You know, the generally speaking, the kind of established parties of left and right in most countries, even, you know, taken as a given, the kind of populist upsurges we've seen, kind of dancing on the head of a pin. The big debates over the economy seem to be more or less be over. But at the same time, here is a moral mission. So you see it with climate change, you see it with nanny statism, you see it with wokeism at certain points as well, where it's just that they a lot of them are just in power because they want to be in power, but they have to pretend like they stand for something. So telling you not to vape, even if it means maybe you know half your city going up in flames, it will apparently give you a serviceable standing, I guess, for some of these
but
people.
I think that's very true, Tom. But Will, do you think that this kind of stuff has genuine support amongst the median Australian? Because I get the impression in Ireland, which I would say in many respects has a similar kind of vibe, or certainly a similar reputation. And obviously, there was a huge number of Irish went to Australia. Is there a lot of grassroots support for this, or is it more like I sense it is in Ireland, where it's just like, well, we have these leaders, they're a bunch of idiots, and we kind of put up with it, we get around the law as much as we can?
Yeah, I don't have this precise numbers, but I think, and quite troublingly, there is a huge amount of people who are very comfortable having their freedoms taken away from them, not just when it comes to vaping, but across a whole range of areas. Again, we spoke about this the other day, and you're framing a lot of these sorts of nanny state policies as a top-down, you know, top-down phenomena, weak leaders basically pushing their agendas onto the public. And I'm really concerned in Australia that you have a lot of people who are very, very comfortable with nanny statism. And I think that's been reinforced to them over 30, 40 years now. So they're used to it. And you also, I think, have increasingly a culture of dobbing on your neighbour and basically picking people out to if they are breaking the law or breaking the rules. So, yeah, I think it is troubling, but I think there is very much on the average man and woman on the street, many of them are very comfortable with this stuff.
Because it's not their freedom's been interfered with.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. I think there's also just this broader mindset that prioritises safety over liberty and your, you know, individual security over liberty. And I think that, again, in part comes down to political leadership. in that for 40 years. No, sorry. For 20 years in Australia, you haven't had political leaders who have been capable of making the case, of selling a vision, of selling a message. And it's another really interesting phenomenon, which is common across the UK, Australia, the US, that since the 80s and 90s, you have had this cohort of very, very weak leaders. You look at the Conservatives in the UK, that was mirrored by a very similar era of right-wing politics in Australia. And I do sometimes wonder, and I've got a point of view on it, but whether the West is going through an unusual bad trot when it comes to leadership, and this is a cyclical problem, or whether it is systemic, and it is now almost impossible to be an effective leader of a Western democracy in 2025.
But when you, I agree that people are apathetic because it doesn't really affect them a lot of time. But when you've got firebombings on an almost daily basis, gangland shootings are in the news pretty frequently, and the whole, this is the term, tobacco turf war, has been normalised in the space of quite a short amount of time. I haven't been to Australia for a long time, so I don't know what the feeling on the street is, but you would think that would wake people up a bit, because it's the kind of thing that libertarians like me have been sort of predicting, but even our sort of darkest predictions weren't as bad as what's going on in Australia.
Yeah.
And it makes you think, well, if people aren't going to like snap out of it, when you've got kind of war on drugs, Al Capone style violence going on a regular basis in the suburbs, what the hell will?
Well, I think a lot of people don't make the connection between the nanny state policy and the crime.
Why not?
It's a really good question. It's a really good question. But I think they would go, oh, well, that is a problem with gangland crime. That is not necessarily a problem with the policy. I think in part it is because leaders aren't making the case effectively. But there certainly isn't a mood that says, well, because of these second order consequences, we now need to rethink the actual policy of effectively prohibition.
And presumably it's the case that both of the two main parties, their kind of fingerprints are all over this nanny statism. So it becomes very difficult for any of them to call it into question or to say maybe it's gone too far, because they've all pretty much been on the same hymn sheet. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right. So the easiest way to think of it, there are variations, but the movement of the Liberal and National parties in Australia, collectively the coalition, has been a very similar movement to what has happened with the Conservatives in the UK. You know, think kind of wet Lib Dem style politics, evacuation of any sort of traditional conservative principles or any sort of traditional classical liberal principles into the, now this sort of vague nothingness that you get from them. And it will be really interesting whether there is a sort of reform style movement in Australia which could potentially put the Liberal Party, one of the most successful political parties in modern Western history, in jeopardy. It is not outside the realms of possibility.
And any signs of it thus far, or is it all just very kind of at the edges?
So what Australia doesn't have is that they don't have that sort of charismatic leader like a Farage who could galvanise support around this sort of movement, and they would need that in order to be effective. The only person I can think of who could potentially do it is Tony Abbott, former Prime Minister, who was the Prime Minister who stopped the boats, but he is too loyal to the Liberal Party to do that. So I think that is the key ingredient that's missing. And I also think, again, maybe similar to the UK, there is a broader problem on the right in Australia where they don't know what they stand for anymore. So John Howard, who was the Prime Minister from 96 to 2007, referred to the Liberal Party as a broad church, in that you needed to be able to accommodate classical liberals and social conservatives. And that was the only real way to make the electoral maths stack up for a right-wing party. That broad church has now effectively disintegrated in the Liberal Party, and now you've just got sort of vaguely right-wing people all wandering around in different directions without any sort of coherent philosophy. And so the outcome of that is you've got about five or six oddball minor parties on the right that all take about 2 or 3% of the vote, are completely politically ineffective. But in order to have that sort of wider movement, like a reform movement, you need to find some sort of a way to bring those groups together. And there's no real appetite that I can see to do that so far.
So if all the talk of firebombings hasn't put you off visiting Australia already, should we talk about the Death Cap Mushroom Trial, which sounds like a strange band name, but is actually the trial which has been gripping Australia as well as much of the world. This is the story of a woman called Erin Patterson, who's on trial for the murder of, I think, four of her kind of family members or extended family members, as well as the attempted murder of another, allegedly invited them all round for dinner to make some alleged announcement about her needing to undergo some kind of procedure. But anyway, the long and short of it is she fed them a beef Wellington that was laced with poisonous mushrooms. So it's an incredible story. I think Chris has probably brought this up because he's developed an unhealthy obsession with unlikely, alleged, in this case, killers. But Will, do you want to enlighten us a bit about what's been going on here? I think on the day of recording, it's the 29th day of the trial, so it's really been wearing on. But what are the kind of key points to take away from this?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Number one, this mushrooms were actually going to be on my shortlist for things that I would ban.
And not just the poisonous ones, to be clear, like just in general.
I agree. Okay, right, yeah.
They are a fungus. They grow on rocks. You shouldn't eat them. And I think this actually really validates my prospective mushroom ban. Look, it is an interesting one. I'm tempted to play the Peter Hitchens role to the Christopher Snowden and basically say that this loony woman is innocent.
No one saw her do anything.
She doesn't seem the type, Chris.
Well, the one thing which is interesting is like it is at the moment circumstantial.
In that case, she must be innocent.
There is that similarity. But apparently she said she was inviting over these acquaintances. They weren't family members. I think they were family friends or something like that. In order to discuss a prospective health issue that she was having, the prosecution have said, well, no, that's garbage.
Well, yeah, because she said she had cancer and she doesn't.
Yeah, so she's previously lied about her health before.
Allegedly.
And she said that was,
I'm going to keep saying that all the way through.
No, she hasn't got cancer. That's a fact.
No, that's true. But she's claiming that she actually, I think, it was to announce that she was going to get a gastric ban. Yeah. But there's now questions about whether or not she was actually going to undergo
that. I thought she said she had cancer.
No, that was the original cover story. She's now said actually she was going to get some sort of weight loss procedure. And now they're saying the clinic...
You invited us around to tell us that.
It's one of many holes in this story, I think. So,
yeah.
So, but Will, sorry.
So she apparently had a spare dodgy mushroom pie ready to go if the first one didn't work. and apparently it was very, very unusual for her to be socialising in this way. You know, something is up.
Yeah.
So look, time will tell. It is the case that has
gripped
the nation. Yep. Which I think possibly says more about Australia than the case itself.
All the details, I think, which is probably why it's a great one. Of the reasons it's a great story, like supposedly she dished up all of the poisonous mushroom-laced beef Wellington on one colour plate for all of her guests, but then a smaller kind of different coloured plate for herself.
Yeah, that kind of thing, allegedly.
It was all, you know, it's got everything.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, the giveaway is that she managed to escape the dodgy pie. Mm.
She only had a bit of it. I think she went off and was sick.
Yeah, well, that's quite clever, really.
It's very clever.
Yeah, because if you were going to be completely guilty, you'd just avoid the pie or you'd create a different pie. Mm. So she actually fully committed to the bit by just, you know, having maybe a couple of mouthfuls.
How the poison throw up. There's a bit similar like in Narcos, I think, when someone does something similar, passes around a glass. But glasses full of poison quickly goes in.
Well, Chris, if you wanted to get rid of a few, you know, characters that you would rather not have in your life, how would you dispose of them?
Well, I wouldn't involve mushrooms, because I feel exactly the same way about mushrooms. You do horrible, slimy things.
Awful.
How can you eat something that grows in the dark? And it is frequently poisonous.
They're a fungus.
I don't believe in God as such, but like if you create something that is, firstly, tastes disgusting, can only be grown in slimy, dark, horrible places. Yeah. Unlike every other thing we eat,
this sounds
needs light.
This sounds a bit like victim blaming to me. You're saying that they brought it on themselves by eating in.
Well, in a way, yes. If they were sensible, they wouldn't have eaten the mushrooms, would they? They would have done what I would have done, which is pushed them to the side of the plate and ate the beef.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry, what was the question?
Well, if you weren't going to use mushrooms, how would you get rid of someone?
Oh,
a new segment on the show, that's good. I can imagine it's something you devote a lot of
thought
to.
I'm not going
to
say on air, am I? I mean, goodness sake, I haven't done it
yet. So you've actually got plans to do it? That's
well, I'm not saying, I'm not going to incriminate myself very popular podcast.
On a separate but related note, and look, this is probably a good thing, but modern technology has completely destroyed the serial killer industry. You know, I just felt like in the 70s and 80s, so many serial killers.
A lot of serial killers.
And a lot of crackers, you know, your Ted Bundys and your Dahmers and all that. Yeah. with modern technology and cameras everywhere and DNA evidence, it really, I think, has narrowed the lane for serial killers.
It's a tragedy, isn't it?
It is a tragedy.
Because what are people going to watch on Netflix?
Exactly. What are they going to be over?
You make a good point, Will. Obviously, it's harder to commit a lot of crimes these days, apart from shoplifting in London and everybody else in London. But like serious crimes like that, police actually do pay attention to. But have they stopped, or have serial killers just got better at disposing of the bodies of drifters?
Yeah.
So we don't know.
It's an interesting question, isn't it?
We don't even know murders have been committed.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would have gone down. Food for thought.
Or maybe
they've just adapted. They've probably used the technology themselves.
I think, as in most cases, younger generations just have less get up and go than they used to do. You know, you see it in this area, you see it in all kinds of other ones. It wouldn't surprise me.
They're not leaving the house. You're never going to leave the house. You're never going to kill 14 people.
You know, like that's just
live a little.
I hadn't thought about the decline of serial killers as a sign of civilizational decay, but
it's an idea.
It's an idea.
It's something to ponder.
It's something to ponder.
So before we move on to the before we start talking about some bands and so on, I understand, Chris, that you've got something that you want to it's a kind of travel related grievance, I hasten to say, so please just
involves people getting my way on the pavement, which is obviously a common theme on this podcast, but I think there's also more to it than that, Tom. I think it speaks to something broader. I've noticed recently, since COVID in fact, that quite often now when I go to the Pelican Crossing, the pedestrian crossing, where you press the button, that sometimes there can be 9 or 10 people stood at the crossing waiting, and I've been waiting there for who knows how long when I turn up and press the button because no one's pressed the button. People are not pressing the button at Pelican Crossings anymore. I would say 1 in 3 times when I go to the Pelican Crossing near me, it is not being pushed, and there's people standing gormlessly just assuming something's going to happen. It used to be the opposite. It used to be that someone would already push a button, then other people would come up and push a button. Remember those days before COVID, everyone became a zombie? And I mentioned this to somebody the other day, and he said he'd seen exactly the same thing. So that makes me, that's good enough for me. This is obviously widespread national
problem. Does pushing
the
button make a difference, though? Because there's widespread debate about this.
On some junctions where it's all basically automated, it doesn't make any difference. Fine. I'm talking about just a single lane road where you have to push a button in order to activate the red light. And this I never saw before COVID. Like I say, it used to be the opposite way around. And I think it's symptomatic of a broader issue in society in which COVID somehow made people thick and lazy. And you must have noticed this. The productivity. It's a miracle we haven't had a permanent recession, really, since COVID. It's a victory for Rachel Reeves that we've had any growth whatsoever, because everyone now is useless. If you ask anyone to do anything in any kind of commercial environment, customer service, something like that, it's at best 50-50 that it's going to happen. And it's almost now you just assume it won't happen. Like trying to get a waiter over, anything. People are just useless. They don't see why they should work because they went a while during lockdowns not having to work, and now they begrudge it. And if you don't actually force them to do it, they won't do it. And on things like pushing a button at a pedestrian crossing where no one's telling them to do anything, they're just helpless. They're helpless as a kitten.
Helpless as a kitten. Is it also, we've talked extensively on this show about the phenomenon of people like queuing in pubs. Is it just that people have forgotten how things should actually work? Like they've just become kind of desocialised and...
Well, I've got a different theory for that, which I had also proven by an N=1 experiment the other day. I was in the old Cheshire Cheese pub, Fleet Street, one of Orwell's favourites. Lovely old pub.
Yeah, it's great.
My theory has always been that what happens is when the bar's quiet, somebody goes up to the bar, one person, and then some American tourist, it could be any tourist really, but probably an American, is going to stand behind them. And then other people who are not tourists, and may even be British, go, oh, that's how it is in this pub. And they start forming an orderly queue. I think that's what happens. And in the old Cheshire Cheese, I saw this with my own eyes because somebody went up to the bar and some very, very loud, annoying American people who were drowning the place out with their yelling and carrying on. One of them went to the bar and stood behind. And I saw it. Saw it happen. It's not often you can see it happen, but I saw it happen on that occasion, and I suspect it's one of very many occasions.
And so
it's
a problem. A precedent.
It's a problem of immigrants, basically.
Or tourists, in fact.
Tourists, yeah, exactly. Former foreigners.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Any presence of them whatsoever you think is now corrosive to the
another reason to stop the boats. No, you're right, Chris.
Stop the cruise ships, please.
Stop the cruise ships. No. You know, you're right. Some people would have seen that as a trivial observation. I don't. I think you're right. There are deeper forces at play. The other one I would add to it is that no one is present in their life anymore. Everyone will be standing at that crossing on their phone, listening to a podcast or music. And half the time, I don't even think it would occur to them to press the button.
They're waiting for someone else to do it.
Well,
that's the problem.
I don't even think they've got that far to having that conscious thought. They're just not engaged in their surroundings. Now I'm sounding like the reactionary GB News commentator that I am. But I'm sad
it's taking this long to get this out of you, but go ahead.
Well, I was explicitly warned before the start of this podcast that to resist that tendency.
You should have heard what you were saying, though. That was, you know.
Yeah, no, there's enough there to have me cancelled 10 times over if that recording was on before we started. But kids today are not engaged with where they are, and as a result of that, you have these like bizarre broader trends that are playing out, like kids are having, and I'm probably going off on a tangent, but you know, kids are having their sex, they're doing less drugs, they're drinking less. You know, it really, I think, is
teenage pregnancies falling off a cliff.
Yeah,
it's like one social tragedy after another.
Exactly right. Less serial killers, less teen pregnancy. Yeah. Like, what is happening in society today?
Fewer.
But it's
it's important.
But Chris, here's a question for you. How do you think younger people today think about
the voice of the younger generation?
I
have a teenager.
How do you think they think about freedom? And do you think that their conceptions of freedom are different to older generations?
Hard to say. As Tom's pointed out, I'm not a young man. My daughter is very sound on freedom, I have to say. And the only other young people I regularly see are people at schools and universities, many universities, who are at things like the University Libertarian Society. So it might be slightly off skew. I have a little bit of faith in Gen Z, actually. I think there's a bit of a backlash coming there.
Yeah.
Based purely on my daughter's cohort of 13-year-olds. I don't think their youth are as bad as
I keep hearing
out.
Competing things about Gen Z. Yeah. Depending on who you talk to, they're either all trans or they're all fascists.
Yeah, it's and almost like you can't generalise over
the truth
like
is probably somewhere in between, you know. Yeah.
Do you think that this...
I heard an interesting story at Oxford the other day. Sorry to interrupt, I just remembered. I noticed they had the LGBTQ flag flying. Yep. I don't even know what to call it anymore. Is that called the Pride flag? Like the really ornate, medieval heraldry one with the black triangle. That's the progress pride flag.
I thought that was a trans flag.
They had that flying all over the place.
Trans is a whole other kettle of fish. I don't know why I know this.
I saw the other day, even the asexuals have their own flag.
They do. And thank God they've finally got
very
some.
Very persecuted.
Sorry, go on.
I said, is this because of pride? They went flying all the time. And they said, it's just for pride, really. But apparently the local Islamic society, whatever it's called, they're not that keen on having the gay flag.
Who'd have thought?
Yeah. And so they had a vote to get it taken down. And apparently there were gay people voting alongside the Islamic society to take it down because they were so torn over Palestine.
But in the end, they sided with the
Is that a good development?
To take down.
Is that a bad development?
From my perspective, it's very difficult to weigh up, you know, who is the alien, who's the predator in this one, you know. But it is
a microcosm of the weird contradictions in the modern left today. Yes. You have this unholy alliance.
Gays for Palestine.
Yeah.
Is the best one.
Unholy alliance between kind of identity politics loonies and religious nutcases. And it's fascinating when the identity politics hierarchy is in place and then you start to see frictions between those different levels on the identity politics hierarchy.
Yeah.
So, for example, the way that, you know, you could make the argument that the treatment of women in fundamentalist Islamic cultures is problematic, to use the parlance of our times.
Very topical this week with all the burqa chat that's been going on. Absolutely. Yeah,
and you know, if you're on the left, you kind of have this difficult situation of going, oh, well, I, you know, support this oppressed minority, but I also support this oppressed minority, so how do I try and square that circle? And the point is you can't. It's logically incoherent.
It's almost like better to have principles and, you know, coherent positions on things.
What a quaint idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to ask, on the subject of young people, because it looks like the they're going to push ahead with this reduction in the voting age to 16. Do you think that will have a material impact on politics?
It would be hilarious if that's what ushered in the reform landslide.
Yeah, it would.
You know?
It would be.
That was the cherry on the cake that it required, amazing. You know. Because there are some signs of that.
There are some signs of it, but
it's
actually a bit overstated.
But, it's massively overstated. Yeah. There are basically more young people who love reform than lefties would assume.
Yeah.
Because not just lefties, everyone would assume that, you know, young, inexperienced, naive and ignorant people would be more likely to vote for a socialist party, obviously. And they are, on balance. But there's more of them than you might think. And who knows, over the next few years, that could grow. I think, yeah, I don't know, man. I haven't got my finger on the pulse, have I? But wouldn't surprise me if the teenagers today turn out to be really quite right-wing.
Yeah, but it's not a majority. You're still going to have them skewing left.
They'll go green, won't they, yeah.
I guess they'll go green, but...
We're wasting the vote.
And what is it? So that's 2 years, year groups, cohorts. Was a bit, 3 or 4% of the vote, 2% of the vote?
What's 2 or 3%?
Of the total electoral population.
Yeah.
It surely will have an impact, I would have thought.
We shall see.
We shall see. But they might not bother turning out. Well, you've got to remember, young people are least likely to turn out.
No, exactly.
Even if they're 18 to 21. So how unlikely are these 16 to 17-year-olds?
I don't know.
I don't know. I just say let them smoke and drink and gamble. That's all.
I'm surprised you'd say something. But,
if we're going to let them vote, at least let them drink and smoke
and gamble. Oh, right, I see. Right, it's the point about that. I thought you just, in general, thought that was a good thing to promote.
Well, I'm quite happy just saying adulthood starts at 16. I'm absolutely comfortable with
that. But we've got to be consistent about it.
We should be consistent about it. If you had to ask me, where should it be, 21, 18 or 16, I would say 16 every single time. I remember being 16 and I thought it was ridiculous. I wasn't allowed to drink and gamble and all this kind of stuff. And I see 16-year-old now who look like 20. You see him playing football. Yeah, Wayne Rooney was playing Premiership football at the age of 15 with a beard.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, when he couldn't slightly buy special a case, drink from the fridge. Well, maybe so. Which is why I mention him, I suppose. But you still, you see people who are 16,
he was a man with much older tastes in many, many ways.
Yeah, you look at a bloke who's 16, 17, you go, that's a man. You look at a girl, a teenager who's 16, 17, you go, she's a woman. Just, I mean, they're fully grown. Obviously, they're not, you know, they haven't got the maturity that other people have. But, you know, who has? I haven't got the maturity that a 7-year-old has.
Exactly. You know what I mean? So let's move on from Chris staring at kids.
Where did we start with this? Oh, Pelican Crossings. That was the Pelican Crossing item.
No, exactly. That was the Pelican Crossing segment. How are we going to wrap that one up?
There have been actually a great deal of nanny state stories this week, so we've got to find a way to fill the time.
We've done amazingly well. I think we had a really valiant effort.
I think we've done
too
well,
to actually fill in the gap. But, Will, before we go, as you'll know, as the listeners of the show, we always ask our guests this one final question. If you had to have one ban, what would it be? If you were a dictator for a day, what would you get rid of? The only rule is that it can't be worthy.
You are a dictator. Ah.
You can't ban hunger or, you know, try to usher in world peace.
I certainly wouldn't bother banning hunger anyway. population control. Cut that, maybe.
He was expecting a laugh. It didn't come. Was he being serious?
I would actually take a leaf out of the leftist playbook, and I would completely reorient language to suit my whims.
Mm.
So I would ban several words. I hate the word Americano for a long black.
Mm.
I'd get rid of that. I would...
I hate the long black as well, to be honest with you.
You don't like long black?
No, I don't like any of the Australian words for coffees. They're really annoying.
Australia
flat
does.
White and all this. I don't know what these things are. I do like America. Sorry, I'll let
you
go in a minute.
Let me finish, please, before you criticise.
Just on that point. Americano just means a filter coffee. I can understand that. And then I can have Americano with milk. White Americano, just a white coffee. Flat whites, I don't know what they are. So I've got too much milk in as far as I can see. What's the other one you said?
Well, you've got long black.
Yeah, a long black. What the hell? What's that? What does it mean?
It's long.
Why
and
is
it's
it
black.
Long?
It's, you know, it's actually it's quite descriptive of what
high.
The coffee is.
It's high. It's a high cup, is it?
Yeah, and it's just black coffee. So
I feel like this is the wrong person to be having this debate with. Because
I've
heard Chris make trench and defensive instant coffee before.
But the point is, you know,
I did get confused when I was Australia in coffee shops. That's all I'm saying.
And that's where it all comes from, really, isn't it? If you're honest,
I think Australia has earned the right to actually start labelling coffees because they do very good coffee.
White coffee, whereas, black coffee. They're the two coffees.
Yeah.
This is who you're dealing with, so ignore him, basically.
We're all the sugar.
I can tolerate American cultural imperialism, but not when it's stuff that they do, which is so rubbish, and coffee for them is so rubbish. Anyway, I would put people in jail for life who say H instead of H.
Mm. Yeah, that's fine, yeah. That's sensible policies for
sensible
happy
people. I'm saying black up.
No, you're talking, yeah.
Get rid of all emojis entirely.
No, I like emojis.
No, they are
I like
making...
the thumbs up emoji the best.
Yeah.
It's so ambiguous.
But that's entirely the point. It basically means we are getting lazy and we are... dumbing down
not
our
at all. It takes a while. You have to switch from UK English to emoji and then pick the emoji and put it back again. You can type in yes, to be fair, then pick the...
Do you put a lot of thought into your emojis?
If I have to do that? Yeah, I do, yeah. Yeah. I've got three emojis I use a lot.
I think they are dumbing us down. There would be a long list of other words that I would ban, which again, you know, the left have done very effectively. I think it's my turn to basically.
Which other ones would you ban? Apart from, what is it? American, white Americano.
What else?
I'll put you on the spot here. Apologies.
Yeah.
Not least because you derailed his whole pitch by constantly nitpicking.
Yeah.
Which you've never done with any of the previous guests. I don't know what's got into you today, but this is.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Will. I'm sorry, viewers. You had to see that.
No, but that's all right.
You just brought back from 20 years ago my annoyance of being an Australian
shop
and not knowing what I was buying.
No, that's right. You're just a racist, that's fine.
Getting a coffee that was mostly milk. Yeah, what the hell do you call this?
I'm glad we've ended this podcast all about Australia by you admitting your deeply held, long-standing prejudice towards Australia.
I love Australia. So, you know. I love Australia. I spent 6 months of my life in Australia.
No, did you?
Over two different backpacking episodes. And... I loved it, but alas, I would never go back because of the nanny state. I'm quite interested to go back and see the firebombing situation, see how bad it is. Get down Melbourne.
No, exactly. Well, if you paid all that money for the ticket and you just don't, you know, just miss it, it's like the Northern Lights or whatever, you know, you go at the wrong time.
But it's a beautiful country, and I actually like the people of Australia, and it's a hell of a lot better than their nearest neighbours. Where do you think I should immigrate to? Because I'm sick of it. I'll give you a short list, right? Malta. Gibraltar. Is there any else rhymes with that? What's on my shortlist? I can't remember. Cyprus.
Why Gibraltar, though, other than the fact that it's
English-speaking
territory? Oh, I see. Because it is just
Falkland
like...
Falkland Sandwich Islands. Don't know anything about them. Yeah. They're British, I believe.
Is it just any kind of... British overseas territories, basically.
Ideally...
Chagos was on the list until 5 minutes ago.
You'll have to get in quick. They're all going to be sold off. They're going to be given away with payments included as part of the deal.
If I'd never heard of the Chagos Islands, they were given away. But they sound like... kind of place I might have gone to. If they drive on the left and speak English, that's my main criteria.
I don't think anyone had heard of the Chagos Islands. But it didn't stop me from getting remarkably angry in a very short space of time.
That is your job.
Where should I go?
The Falklands.
The Falklands.
I think, from everything I've heard, you know, the whole more British than the British thing, I can't say I've been. I can't say I am up to date with modern Falklands culture. But I get a feeling that could actually be what this country used to be. It could almost be a bit of a time capsule. And I think you'd love that. Basically, just take me back to, you know, Britain of the...
Take me back to dear old Blighty.
And on that note, quite literally, up the Falklands, down with Australia, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Last Orders. If you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you subscribe and click the bell so that you never miss another Spiked video. If you're listening to this on your podcast app, make sure you subscribe there and leave us a glowing 5-star review. And if you'd like to get in touch with your questions or band suggestions, email us at lastorders@spiked-online.com.